This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia. From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Danielle Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leon and written by Bettina Jilliwa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. I am Amanda Nduka.
And I am Dino Ray Ramos, and this week we have another special
bonus.
In the Heights episode. It's in the Heights week.
Let's just say that.
So we have director John M. Chu and the man himself who created In the Heights, Lin-Manuel Miranda. We recorded with them separately,
yeah.
But it's one episode because
right.
It's in the Heights.
We're celebrating this movie, you guys, because obviously this is a podcast about representation. This film is, I don't know if it's the first film in a while. I can't think of a movie that I've just been of all Latino cast.
No, it's like the last one probably by a major studio was probably La Bamba,
which was in the 80s. So this is
or maybe Selena, yeah.
We have to go, but even at this scope though, like this cast and the dance numbers and the production of it, like I don't know if we've seen a production of this type of scope with a Latino cast. And you guys, when I say like I think this film is for the culture, like I said, we talked about this before with Anthony, with Lynn, but we just got the same type of chills that I got watching, like I said, Black Panther, Crazy Rich Asians, things that are just such big scope with people people of color as the center. The way that you get a feeling of this is what we've needed is what I got from In the Heights. I was very excited about it. The dance numbers were amazing. I mean, John, he's done Step Up.
Yeah, I think it's just because John Chu, he really knows how to frame a shot. And
yeah.
He knows how to handle dancers and performers. Like, there are multiple dance, like huge ensemble numbers that kind of just are amazing to watch. Like the
spectacle. Will blow your mind, yeah.
Every single corner of the screen, something's happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes this very much a production and something to watch in the theater, if I'm being honest. If you're vaccinated, I mean, we talk about this in the episode with John, but if you're vaccinated, I really encourage you to go.
Me
you
too.
Know, just wear a mask.
It's safe, guys. I didn't feel uncomfortable whatsoever. Yeah. Wear a mask, but this is definitely a film that needs to be experienced on the big screen. I thoroughly enjoyed it. John, we just love him. Like, he's done Crazy Rich Asians. He's doing Wicked next. Another very popular Broadway play. I just think he's really making a name for himself, and I'm loving seeing his direction. Like, how many Asian American directors are can we think of that are, you know, in the studios making films?
And also, he's been doing the work, and it feels like he's just now getting noticed. But he's been around, and it's, of course, and then we have Lin as well, who's Lin-Manuel Hamilton.
Exactly.
And he's also doing
all the awards.
Tick Tick Boom is going to be his feature directorial debut. So, and you know, of course, and he is also in The Heights,
right?
But just to see his work be on the screen finally, in a narrative form. I mean, we had like Hamilton on Disney Plus and everything, but I think this is a whole different thing because In the Heights kind of put Lin-Manuel on the map, and just to have this Broadway play finally reach screen.
It was a long journey.
Both of them here.
Yeah. And like I said, like we said, you guys go see this movie in the theaters. It's the only way to, well, not the only way. If you don't, please, if you're uncomfortable, HBO Max, HBO Max it. but if not, let's support these theaters, guys, because we don't want these to go away. Yeah. So without further ado, here is John and Lin.
Mm-hmm.
John, welcome.
Thank you for
joining us today. Welcome to Deadline's new Hollywood podcast.
All right.
Obviously, you are the director of an amazing film called In the Heights. We will get to that. Yes, we loved it. We will get to that later. But before we jump into all that, we like to on this podcast kind of start off about getting to a little bit about your journey to get to the point where you're at right now. So I know you grew up in California, correct?
Yeah, Northern California in Los Altos.
Yes,
Bay Area.
Right, that's
great. So at what point in your life did you realize that you wanted to be a director and producer? I know you went to USC Film School, but what point did you,
I was very lucky. I was really young. My parents would give me, I'm the youngest of five kids and grew up in a Chinese restaurant, and my parents would take us on vacations, all five of us, in a nutty way. And they gave me the video camera to carry, one of those ones you put on your shoulder. And I would lug that around and I would just shoot my own videos during that. So, and then once I started to edit it together, I got this little mixer from Sharper Image. I showed my parents and they started to cry when they watched it. And so I knew at that point, like, there's a voice here. They're listening to me finally after all these years.
That's so cool. But,
yeah. Did your camera have a, like, did you have to carry the VCR on the side? Was it one of those, like, really old school ones? Because we had one of those.
Yeah, I know what those are, but this was built in, so I had to, like...
Oh, so you had, like, the advanced one.
It was maybe, It didn't skip at Radio Shack, okay?
Radio Shack.
Radio Shack. Oh, shout out to Radio Shack, you guys.
Shout out to Radio Shack. You mentioned Radio Shack and Sharper Image, so
yeah.
We used to play with all the cameras at Fry's.
Fry's.
Shout out to Fry's. You're just taking this back. Is Fry's still around? I don't even know.
No, they closed a lot. There was one in San Jose I used to go to a lot when I lived in the Bay Area. But anyway,
it was like an amusement park.
It was like a Saturday during the daytime, like, adventure.
In Palo Alto it was a cowboy theme, and it was in the spot and right behind it was where PDI started, where DreamWorks Animation started. So I would like look around, like, they're making Ant somewhere here.
That's cool. And that's cool that your parents were very supportive. Are they first generation?
They're first generation. They moved here when they were 19, 20 years old. I'm named after a TV show. My sister and I, Jennifer and Jonathan, after Jennifer and Jonathan Hart from Heart to Heart.
From Heart to Heart? Really? I did not know this.
Oh my gosh. That's so cool.
So yeah. They adored media, apparently. I think that's why they cried when they watched that video of us. I think they saw themselves on TV the way that they worshipped, and we were just a regular family having a good time. And I think that moved them.
I love that. I love that. And I love that they were so supportive, especially being first generation. We have a bunch of first generation people on the show all the time. And we always talk about how it's really hard to, to get support in these types of entertainment fields, arts, creative fields. So it's really great that your parents were really supportive of you from the jump.
They weren't always, there was a moment.
Well, they had to fit it in there somehow.
I was editing something at like 3 a.m. for my school because I had convinced my teachers to like let me make videos instead of write papers. So I'd stay up all night. I need sleep. And my mom came in, she was so angry, and she unplugged my computer. And back then, if you unplug your computer, you lose
everything's lost.
Yes.
And I was like devastated. And she's like, you've conned your school. You have to write papers. This is not.
Wow. Yeah.
I went back in her room that night, bawling my eyes out. And I was like, you always told me to follow my dreams. It was like a Lifetime movie moment. When my movie becomes a Lifetime movie, this will be that winning moment. And I said, this is what I love. You're going to be with me or against me. And she's like, I'm against you. Go back to me. And I went to sleep. And the next day she showed up with a pile of filmmaking books. And she said, you're going to do this. You have to study it like a real craft. And you have to learn and study about it. And
yes,
at my back.
Oh, okay. So besides that, the literature that your mom gave you, were there any other filmmakers or storytellers that you looked up to that sort of informed the type of approach that you wanted to take with your career?
Yeah, I mean, I think Steven Spielberg always was, that was us. It was in the 80s.
Yeah.
E.T. Blew my mind open. Jaws. By the way, we could watch anything. We were watching Nightmare on Elm Street, DreamWorks.
Wow.
It was like little. So it was always around us. And Tim Burton, when Batman came out, I remember getting the soundtrack. I remember getting the toys.
Yes.
It wasn't just the movie. It was the event of going and creating your own stories when you got home and doing the Batman dance or whatever was happening.
Oh my God, like, Batman, Prince, Bat dance.
It was so good.
Yeah.
And that whole thing moved me and made me feel like, oh, this is like, this is, you can create this for people. And that was very powerful for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, you, we were, right before you came on, we were talking about kind of your films, the, you know, Step Up 2 and like the dance, your kind of connection to music and dance oriented projects, not just like features, but, you know, even the Justin Bieber doc, you know, I think, you know, that, you know, me and Jenny Amato have been talking about doing a whole Step Up, you know, festival, because I love any dance, you know, film. But, you know, even like with Gem and the Holograms, and, you know, and then was there any point where you felt the need to tell Asian narratives before Crazy Rich Asians? Or did you have like, you know, did you feel any pressure because you were probably one of the only Asian American filmmakers, you know, during out there who was like a household name in Hollywood, that Hollywood spotlighted? Did you ever feel the need that you're like, or like even, I don't want to say burden, but it is, that's like the only way I could describe it. But like, just like pressure, just like, because you were an Asian face in the public, and did you feel the need to kind of tell our stories, or this pressure?
I think I felt a little bit of that in college when I was sort of finding my voice at USC. And I did a short film called Silent Beats, which you can look up on YouTube. It still gets shown at schools around the world, which is crazy. 5 minute short to all the tap rhythms about your first impressions of people when you see them and your judgments on them and being aware of that. And my next one, I was like, I want to go further. I want to tackle this, my cultural identity crisis, in this little short film called Guaylo, The Little Foreigner. And it was a musical, and we screened it for the whole school. They choose only four directors for your final thesis film at USC. And so I was one of those that got chosen for this script. And it was a huge hit. The problem was I felt very self-conscious of it. I was like, I don't know if I got this right. I don't even know what Asian American really means. Like, I couldn't show it. It was very difficult for me to show. And so I didn't put it into festivals, which is very unfair to my crew and cast. I didn't do anything with it. I sort of buried it. And my next film was a musical, but I didn't include my Asian cultural identity in it. And that's the musical that blew up, that got me, gave me my calling card that Steven Spielberg saw, that got me into the studio business. So in a weird that way, that tweak and not feeling like I wasn't ready to tell that yet, convinced me that I needed to just be a director, not an Asian American director at the time. And I thought that was the way to do it. It wasn't until, you know, doing all these movies, Justin Bieber, working with The Rock, working with Mark Ruffalo and Michael Caine and Morgan Freeman, that I came to the end of that and being like, but what am I? And there was a movement happening around about Oscar So White and how Hollywood was really messing things up. And I was like, oh, I am one of those people. And it made me revisit that idea. And I felt, I think, confident the first time in my life, like, oh, I'm here in this industry. I'm not fighting for myself now. And I think I can I made enough money for people. I think I can squeeze one in. And I'm going to tackle something that's scary for me, which is that cultural identity. So it took a decade to come back to try to tackle that. At that point, I was like, I was like, hell yeah, I'm an Asian American director. Like, yeah. And that's what makes, because that's my superpower. And so that's where Crazy Rich Asians came from. That's where In the Heights came from. I signed on for both at the same time. So it's in the same movie. And those movies changed my life about what I was here to do.
I do think I'm going to, maybe this is a controversial thing to say, but like, people weren't ready for Crazy Rich Asians like 10 years ago. I bet you if that was a movie like that was released, it would have faded into, you know, oblivion. It's like we had Sung Kang on. Well, his episode will be later, but spoiler alert. but we were talking about Better Luck Tomorrow and how that movie came out with such an impact, but that impact faded so fast. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't resonate because of social, there was no social media, there was no really big bolstering, but I think Crazy Rich Asians came out at the perfect time. And now with In the Heights, when you were approached to do In the Heights, was there, I mean, it's a great project and Lynn's great and everyone, we just had Lynn on too. But did you ever think, were you kind of like, oh, wait, maybe a Latino director should handle this? Or, I mean, yeah. It was great to have you there, but how did you kind of finally kind of land, or what kind of conversation did you have with Lynn when you were doing this?
I didn't have that conversation in the beginning. This was like, whatever, 2016. And I didn't think twice about it. And I was like, I know his show spoke to me about even growing up in a Chinese restaurant. Like, I knew what it was like to have aunties and uncles raise you. I knew what the pressure was. I knew who my abuela Claudia was, my boo-boo, who taught me how to make wontons on the table. So that I didn't have it then. After Crazy Rich Asians, after that experience, seeing the audience and the world was sort of catching up with everything. I mean, I always say that Crazy Rich Asians, we didn't like spark that. That was sparked way before us. We are a result of people speaking out. I am a result of people getting into my head and being like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And giving me the strength and the courage, knowing that there's a whole group of people who identify in the same way that I could make this movie. Who knew if it's gonna be a hit, but we could do it for ourselves. After that movie, I went back to Lynn and Kiar and had a very serious conversation. Like, should I be doing this movie? I understand that if there was a Latino director that we wanted to do this, that I'm down. Like, don't let me be in the way. And they didn't hesitate. They're like, you're the one. And by the way, we're going to be there, John. So calm down.
yeah.
They're like, we'll be there to keep you in check.
Yes.
and that's the way it was. It was, I could be an outsider to, as they told me their story, as they invited me into Washington Heights, where the best cafe con leche was, where the best handball games were, that I could see in the same way. I'd never been to Singapore before, but I, in sort of Rachel's eyes, could go there and get the tour and see the things that like surprised me, the things that I had assumptions of that were opposite. And so when I went to Washington Heights those first few times, that's what happened. I was like, wait, this tunnel is incredible. He's like, oh yeah, I used to walk through this tunnel every day to see my abuela. Yeah. Like, we have to shoot in this tunnel. I don't know how we're going to clear all the graffiti, but this is amazing. this is the pool that we used to spend the summers
on. Yeah, you guys shot on location. Yeah, that's really cool.
This pool is huge. I've never seen pools this big before. I'm like, you can't build this. So in a way, because we were a group, it was not me saying, we're going to do this, 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 and this, follow the storyboards. This was, share with me, show me, and let me lean into whatever you want to show. And I'll use my skills. I think I learned a lot of this through the LXD, through learning with dancers. They all invented their own styles of dance, whether it was kicking or flexing. And I didn't know anything about it, but they would tell me the story of why, tell me sort of who created it. And we'd be like, okay, what's a story that evolves that we can build off of that tells that, and let me get out of the way. You know, if you have Matt Chad doing a roboting and your camera spins around, you're running all over him. And we did that at a certain point, but we learned a lesson. Let him do the movement, let him lead it. And so those little lessons, I think, paid off a lot in jumping into In the Heights.
And I read somewhere, I don't know if this is true, but I read somewhere that you also are part of a dance crew. is that a true story?
Is that factual? Or? Is that fake news?
Let's be real. Let's be real. So there was a time, I'm not a dancer, but there was a time, although I took tap dance for 12 years, but that's a separate.
Oh, okay.
Okay, that's going to be part of the- 12 years?
That's a long time.
Yeah. Okay, well, why haven't we seen any of that in action?
I learned my lesson to be behind the camera.
Okay.
That said, dancers were my people. Dancers are my people. I love them so much.
Okay.
And they're my best friends. And so, and the camera could assist them. I could capture it forever.
Yeah.
I could get that moment and I could help it. If I countered them, I could make it feel faster. I could do all sorts of things. So anyway, there was a time when after Step Up 2 that we challenged, me and the dancers of Step Up 2 challenged Miley Cyrus to a dance off. And so it became this big online dance battle, real, with all our dancers.
I remember that.
Versus her dancers. And we made all these videos and I was editing it in my room with Adam Savani. And so we called our dance crew, the Adam Chu dance crew.
Okay.
And we battled and eventually we had all sorts of people on. Like our team, we had like, they had Channing Tatum, which was kind of a slap in our face. And Jennifer.
That is unfair. That's unfair.
They also had like Joey Fatone and they had but we had like Diana Ross. We had Chris Brown.
We had Adam.
So
it was a level playing field, right?
It was like, a level playing field. Yeah. And it was like this weird cultural moment.
Nice.
Popped at the beginning of YouTube. This was 2009. And so I saw the power of creating yourself. Like it reminded me, I'm not a professional movie maker. I make things with my camera and I edit it. And so it reminded me never to wait for permission to make things. And two, YouTube was this new vehicle. And oh my gosh, there's an audience out there that wants to participate with us. And we made t-shirts that they could buy that went all to charity. And they would dance in their cities. And they would swarm Miley's fan sites with these videos. Like we dance for the ACDC and it would just like go off. It was like digital. It was crazy. So anyway, that's probably what they're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. I love that. That is, I think I remember when that was happening. Adam, he has super curly hair, right? Yeah. I can't think of his last name, but I can picture him. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Oh, that's so cool. You mentioned like a cultural moment that was sort of a cultural moment back then. And I like when we were talking about this film, Dino and I, and even when we were talking to Lynn about it, we were kind of like this after watching the movie, it gave us the same type of feeling that we got after watching Black Panther, after watching Crazy Rich Asians, to where this is just such a moment for the culture. Like In the Heights is so big in scope, so colorful, so light, so there's so much meat to it. There's so much cultural meat to it. We get to learn about the different types of Latino cultures. We get to see the different types of people. It was the music was great. The acting, it was just, I felt like this is something that we talk about diversity and inclusion all the time, but we don't really talk about the Latino community whenever it's usually about the Black community, you know, or sometimes the Asian community, but we don't really like to focus. And I think like this movie really gave us what we've been missing when it comes to representation within the Latino community. So for you, when you officially signed on it, what were some of the challenges? What were some of your challenges that you faced taking on this project and with the big production numbers? You had, I know there was one scene, there was like what, 600 dancers in a pool, crazy. How did sort of your experience with doing Step Up and sort of all these other choreographed films help you with this film?
Yeah. Well, in a way it was, there were two, you know, I've worked with Alice Brooks, our cinematographer, since we were students at USC. Chris Scott, he was a dancer in Step Up 2. So I've known him for years and he choreographed all the stuff in our dance battles and then eventually, you know, all our LXD stuff and all my work. And so we had a very tight knit group that had been doing a lot of experiments with dance already. Mm. On the other side was Lynn. And he had Alex Lacamoire and Bill and Kiara. They're all best friends and have been together for years. Mm-hmm. So in a weird way, we had these almost mirror families of people who love to make stuff, who love to make stuff against all odds, who were creating our own stuff. We didn't need anybody else. And we found these, it was like getting married, these two creative families, Voltron'd it up. And you can imagine, like we knew dance and how, and we knew these dancers and we knew their lives and how to express them in the smallest, most intimate ways and the grandest. And then we had the best lyricist and songwriter of our generation who delivered these songs that were true to his own experiences, that were written about the places that we were now going to shoot in. And he had the musical directors that knew the musicians to do this, the best in the world. We knew the best dancers in New York to portray this culture in that. But we had Kiara, whose words are poetry, everything that comes out of her. So she gave it this depth, this intimacy, and all of us together fit into this piece that we were all sharing in the same story that we were trying to tell, which is mm-hmm. that there is no such thing as small stories. That we could have picked anyone on this block to tell. And we chose this one bodega owner and the people around him, and that their dreams and their hopes and their struggles are as important and as big as any movie that we've seen before. And it's through them, not on top of them. This is not a mayor coming to town to buy out the block. And then we have a big musical number of the government coming in to take over. That was not what this movie was. We have no guns, no knives.
Right.
This is inside.
No bad guys.
So the enormity came from the intimacy, actually. Mm-hmm. We had to be with them. We had to feel when we push in on Usnavi and he's looking out that bodega and on our camera is slowly moving in, tightening the screw, and he's dreaming and yearning, and there's a glass in the way. And the reflection in that glass is not the community feeling sad for him, sorry for him, dancing with energy, saying, daring him to break the window, daring him to dream bigger. It's a moment like this that was, and then Anthony has to be up, he has to paint this so finely that he's giving so much truth. He can't say anything without the truth. So he's saying this with his eyes, not even moving. And we're feeling every ounce of this. So every piece had to be together in order to deliver a moment like that. And that had to happen over and over and over and over again. So it was a matter of a lot of communication and process.
Yeah, it's like, at first I thought the whole pool scene was a set piece and I was all, no, that, and I learned that it wasn't. And of course, you know, I did message you about how I was just crying throughout, like from the jump watching it, it's very emotional. And and I'm not even, you know, Latino. And that one scene with Olga, I keep on going back to that. Her number is just fucking amazing. Mm. We stand this movie. Anyways.
That emotion that you're talking about, we felt every day on set.
Yeah.
It was very spiritual. Like we'd show up and we'd see a park full of people of the neighborhood playing hopscotch, playing basketball, hanging out. And one of the background came up to us like, you know, they only shot Law and Order here. And it's always a police officer or a dead body here. Like, this is crazy. That was always moving, always a reminder. There would be people in the neighborhood watching from their windows, and they would be hanging their flag out the windows while we danced. Like, you could not ask for a more beautiful block to be shooting on, people who were supporting you. Yes, they would yell at us if we're in their parking spot, but in love, like family. And that was great. That influenced every ounce. I didn't know if it was going to capture it on film, but when I looked back at the dailies, you could feel it. You can look at anybody in there and they're giving realness.
What was it always the intention to film it on the actual location in Washington Heights?
Yes.
Okay.
It was always sort of the big idea of it. Okay. Like, we're shooting there and we're not taking them anywhere. We're not taking them to a mansion when they dream of a mansion. Mm. We're putting the mansion on the streets. It's like an art installation invading their space, because that's how you dream when you only know those spaces. So we wanted to reflect.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
It was every ounce though. We would be like, should we be doing this on a backlot? It would be a lot easier if we could lift that wall.
Yeah. I'm sure it just brought another sense of another energy, right? Like
champagne that Anthony and Melissa sing at the end, there's no cuts there. That's one shot in a real apartment building.
Yeah.
There's no room. I'm the only one there. And I'm other than the Steadicam guy, and I'm hiding in a bathroom upside down the monitor. They're singing live. So we have a pianist outside on the sidewalk playing with them because they're changing the pace as they're going because they have to act things out. So they're actually arguing while they're singing.
Wow.
And we have actors who can ease in and out of dialogue and music and movement and not feel like they're performing. That scene is like a triumph for me. It's raw. Yeah. We're there. They're so vulnerable. And so it's those moments that I'm like, this is why we're here.
Yeah. Well, John, you have a lot of things in the works. You're just a busy man. So, you know, thank you for even just talking to us, you know.
Yeah.
And you're just like, you know, there's Wicked coming. There's a small thing called Wicked. And congrats. Then the Ty K rescue film. And then you also have Home Before Dark. And then also like the Crazy Rich Asians cinematic universe. Is happening. RACU.
I call it the Chuniverse, but
the Chuniverse! Yes!
Come on, much, universe.
Hashtag.
But, you know, you are doing a lot. But, you know, before we let you go, we always ask this to everyone who comes on our podcast. Is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, writer, producer, creator, anyone who's not in the mainstream that you think people need to know about that deserves more shine, just someone who is doing something really dope that just kind of needs an extra boost?
Mary Choi, she's an amazing writer. Oh my gosh, her books, Permanent Record, is like, so her writing, I don't know, I don't even understand sometimes what she's writing because it's so in the pocket. And I'm like, I need to be younger and I need to be cooler. And I think she's the voice of a whole new generation of people. And I think she's a director. I think she's a writer. I think she's all those things. Maybe doesn't have the experience yet, but yeah. I would do anything to give her that shot because I just think every time I read her and we're working together right now, every time I see something she does, it's just so dope.
Yeah. Mary Choi.
Yeah. Mary Choi. Mary Choi. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? We're looking forward to that.
John, before we let you go, I have to ask you, because I think I'll be remiss if we don't ask, is there any updates on Crazy Rich Asians too?
Yeah. The Chuniverse.
In the Chuniverse. The next installment in the Chuniverse.
The Linematic Chuniverse.
Yeah.
The Linematic. Oh, I love that.
We're going way too far, guys.
Will it be a crossover with Fast and Furious? Who knows?
Step up in space.
Oh, yes.
For me personally, In the Heights is the sequel to Crazy Rich Asians. But that said, on the side, we're working on it. We're working hard. It's got to be great for us to come back.
Yeah. Well, we're looking for it.
Everyone's on such another level. I was with Nora yesterday and it was just like,
oh, it's her birthday yesterday.
Her birthday, yesterday. And what a, I can't believe how much everyone has just grown. I was watching the Immortals trailer where Gemma's the star, and the ad for that, the ad before that was Henry Golding and Snake Eyes. And then the ad after that was Shang-Chi with Nora.
Stop.
And I was like, this is crazy. This is crazy. The biggest
it's crazy rich Asians, crazy.
Way too far now. The biggest legacy of the movie wasn't the movie, it was the people. 100%. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Oh my God. I'm just so excited. You know, thank you so much, John, for joining us and for all that you do. And you know, it's like I always bob
up. You guys, you're on the front lines, amplifying, and I see that every time, and these types follow you and I read. So it's a huge difference. I needed it.
We get excited about projects like this. We're like anything that can help bridge a gap or even like close
just
off
brown and black faces.
Yeah,
period.
Like we get Asian really excited faces, about, and then faces. when it's good, it's even better. So thank you so much.
That's why I think, by the way, cinema can't die, because the box office number does matter. That's how you get attention. That is, of course, if you don't feel comfortable watching HBO Max. However, that number surprises people. It becomes a thing. It becomes a story. It becomes the second story of this.
Right.
And so, where I didn't feel comfortable pushing everyone to the theater, I know now if you're vaccinated, you're ready to go. Like, that number matters, as crass as it is. That's the only democratic part of storytelling anymore. They're not going to tell you how many streams it is. They're not going to tell you how many subscribers they got from it. They make up those. I don't know what those numbers are.
I also think they make it up.
What you spend at that box office, you cannot deny it. That's
you can't.
Fact.
Yeah,
you got to make them.
Yeah.
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 And this is a very theatrical movie. We had to watch it on our because we had screeners.
Yeah, got screeners, but I'm going to the theater watch it.
This should be experiencing.
I'll buy your ticket.
well hopefully thank you so much, John, and you know, hopefully see you in person soon.
Would love that
sooner rather than later, man.
Yeah
thank you so much
and congrats on everything. And
yeah, I have a new baby in a couple weeks.
you're just bit. I don't understand how you do it, but
how does he do it?
But we love that you do, so thank you.
Babies give blessings, so
yes. And didn't you have a baby while you were filming in the Heights? And that's why look at you.
So that was also another pressure.
Is the next baby gonna be what, Wicked, Crazy Rich Asian?
You're gonna mix in your next kid, Elphaba.
Elfie Chu.
Elfie Chu.
Oh, that's cute, Elfie. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia. From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Danielle Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leon and written by Bettina Jilliwa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories.
Lin-Manuel, thank you so much for doing this. I'm Amanda, by the way. I didn't get to introduce myself, but nice to meet you. And thank you so much for doing this for Deadline's New Hollywood podcast. Yeah, obviously, you know, we're here for In the Heights. Dino and I saw it and absolutely loved it.
I saw it twice because I had the link for a limited amount of time.
Yeah, I watched it twice too. So yes, there, like it gave me chills. So congrats on this film and on everything that you've done and accomplished in your career. So many amazing things that we could go through. But so for our podcast, we like to start by asking people about what inspired them to get into this business, and for you, what was that urge for you to become a performer and a storyteller?
Sure. Again, I think of it as like, when does the addiction hit? When do you get that first taste of applause? For me, it was the sixth grade play. We had an amazing music teacher at our elementary school named Barbara Ames, and she would mount a musical with our shop teacher, Robert Sherman, for the sixth graders. So when you're in kindergarten, you go to see the sixth grade play. When you're in first grade, you go to see the sixth grade play. By the time you reach sixth grade, you're so feverish with anticipation. Like, what are they going to do for the musical when we're finally in sixth grade? And when we got there, they ran out of age-appropriate musicals for 12-year-olds. And so we did 20-minute versions of the previous 6 years. So I was a farmer in Oklahoma, a son in Fiddler on the Roof, Bernardo in West Side Story, an Atta Pearl backup in The Wiz, Captain Hook, and Conrad Birdie. And Conrad Birdie is the one that got me hooked on this business because I was 12 years old and very short, and when you play Conrad Birdie, you're Elvis. And my abuela made me a gold lamé jacket. And okay, every nice. Time I sang, one of my classmates had to faint. They had to pretend to be so in love with me.
Oh, yeah.
Faint. And then the song ends and everyone's fainted at your feet. Yeah. That dopamine rush is something I have been chasing since I was 12 years old. Like, you can't give that much attention to a 12-year-old whose parents are always working and is starved for attention. It was a wrap after that.
Yeah. And then obviously, I mean, you've done so many stage plays and Broadway and theater. Was it, you started out writing plays, right? But was it always your sort of goal to be an actor, director, and producer in Hollywood? Was that always sort of your end goal?
Yeah, well, it all happened very organically for me. My first dream was to be a filmmaker. I had the magical experience of my grandfather owned a VHS video store in Puerto Rico for a few summers, Miranda Video.
Nice.
I mean, if you talk to any director, unlimited access to age inappropriate movies is the way in. So it was full exposure to whatever I wanted because my grandparents were working and I had the back of the store. And so I wanted to make movies, and then I fell in love with performing by doing the school play. And I can't tell you what like a magic amulet being a theater kid in high school is, because you make friends with other grades. So when the drama of your grade, which feels so life or death when you're a teenager, is happening, you say, I'm gonna go visit my friends from the play in a different way. the value of making something together when no one's getting paid, it's just about the joy of making something. I think taught me lessons about collaboration and artistic collaboration that I still take with me. It teaches you about leadership because you can't hire or fire anyone. It's just whoever shows up. And the only thing you have to lead them is your vision for what you're making. And so when I got to college, I really wanted to study both theater and film. And then a practicality took over with me choosing theater over film. If you're a theater major at Wesleyan, the department pays for your senior production. If you are a film major, you have to finance your senior film. I knew my parents were killing themselves for me to be able to go to that school. And I wasn't about to then say, and you have to pay for a short film on top of it. I just wasn't going to do it. So I declared theater and not film, and made as much as I could. I watched my sister go through college and what a toll it took on my parents. And I was like, I'm not going to be a burden. I'm just not going to be a burden. I'm going to make as much shit as I can. I cannot graduate with just a Bachelor of Arts under my arm. I'm going to graduate with stuff.
With something, yeah.
This is what I've written. This is what I've written. So I saw that as 4 years of like lab time.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. And it's so interesting. It's like, I was never in theater, but I was in choir. And so there was overlap. Like all my theater friends, I was all, you know, I'm not gonna lie. I was like, oh, some of them are kind of weird, but kind of this cool weird. Like there's this like theater vibe that a specific theater kid has that I just love. And that's like attractive. And like, I see that like with you, even as you're an adult, I'm like, oh, he probably would have been someone I like, you know, kind of hung out with in high school, but you know, navigating through your career, you know, I mean, obviously within the Heights, you know, your culture is very much injected in there, but even with your like kind of these non things, even like, I guess, Hamilton, you would say, but how has your own cultural identity help you inform your choices and like even just your creative process?
Sure. Well, in the Heights, the first version of it was my first attempt to bring my Latinidad to my work. My hero was Jonathan Larson. He wrote rock musicals. My first two musicals are rock musicals. I was just copying my hero. And then in the Heights felt like actually the best way to honor him, because what Jonathan was doing was writing about his community, and he was writing about this disappearing West Village. And so it only makes sense in hindsight that I was like, let me write about my changing neighborhood. And then it really got good when Kiara came on board in 2004. But I don't think Hamilton exists without my particular prism on it, which was, I actually only understand this as a proto-immigrant story. As an immigrant narrative. That was my way in. You know, I didn't have a relationship with the dudes on the money. Like that was not, that was not something I learned a lot about in school or paid attention to in school anyway. I didn't take any history classes in college. And, but the fact that he came from the Caribbean at the same age as my father, and that he was, again, the flip side of it, like had this hunger, had the power to do as many jobs as possible and live as if he was living on borrowed time, but also the flip side that he was viewed with suspicion throughout his career because of that status. Who is this kid? I think John Adams called him the Creole bastard of a Scottish brat. Again, like those epithets are going to get hurled at him in his 30s and 40s. This guy fought in the Revolutionary War. This guy was the first Treasury Secretary, and still because of that status. So to me, it was a hip hop story and a proto-immigrant story. And that was the only way in which I could find my way in. Another person may have read that book and found a completely different way in, but that was my understanding of it. And I think it very much represents that perspective.
Yeah, it's like telling, I think it always goes to that kind of story of like, I'll write what you know or create what you know. And it's like something like our experiences, you know, you know, whatever we write, it's like, oh, it's normal to us, but people think it's groundbreaking, you know.
No one was more surprised by the like outcry over the crazy casting of Hamilton than me. I was like, the idea was a hip hop musical.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I cast brown and black people as the people singing those songs?
Because then it would just be
if it was an all white cast.
But also it would just end up being, I always think of that, like, because I remember I was talking to a friend recently about, like, we were at dinner and we were talking about In the Heights, and he was all, I don't know about rap musicals. And I was all, it's not going to be like that episode of Saved by the Bell where they did Snow White. I don't know. I mean, no shade to that. Where it was just like, oh, my name is Dino and I'm here to say, it's not
that. Well, you know what's so funny though? I mean, again, like, and we can get real deep on this, is that like, I'm born in 1980. So my sister took me to every first Hollywood attempt at figuring out how to incorporate hip hop into the movies. I saw Beat Street in the theater. I saw Breakin' in the theater. I saw Crush Groove as a little boy.
Yeah.
You know, I saw Disorderlies in the
theater. Oh my God, Disorderlies.
On the day of my sixth grade graduation, my sister's present to me was a pair of white Gerbeau jeans. And she took me to see Class Act with Kid and Play. Like, that was my that was my graduation present. Mm-hmm. So, and House Party, and like, again, like, so I lived through like watching that dance between wider culture and hip hop, and the, you know, again, like, my taste is entirely informed by having a cool older sister, and also like the Saved by the Bell rap episode, and my name is Barney Rubble, and I'm here to say I love Fruity Pebbles in a major way. And, but then also Biggie Sprite commercial, Sprite commercial. You know, I like the Sprite in you.
Oh my God, okay.
Like a kiss with a llama twist. Now you know that's kicking words.
So drink up
is drink what, up you, is gotta what you gotta do. Why?
Because I like the Sprite in you. Oh my God.
It was huge. It was huge. You know, go watch Tribe Called Quest's Sprite commercial.
Because
it was a moment.
I performed that exact crisscross rap to the Sprite commercial for our spring pop show my senior year. And I remember I had to do a quick change from a country routine to a hip hop routine. So it was wild. And I'm so glad you brought that up. But, you know, within the Heights, that's been a long journey. And, you know, from, you know, when it was on Broadway to now, but, you know, kind of what does this musical mean to you back? You know, what did the musical mean to you back then compared to now?
Oh, I won't make it through the answer to this question. So apologies in advance. Again, I think, like I said earlier, I think I felt closest to Nina. Nina's stuff was always the hardest to write because it was the closest to the bone. It was the kid who feels out of place in every neighborhood they're in. That was me. I was the kid who went to a fancy school on my block. Yeah. I was the Latino kid at my school, and I was the little gringuito in Vega Alta, Puerto Rico, every summer. I got sent there. I was the one who had the fucked up accent. That was the one that, like, when I wrote Breathe, when I wrote Everything I Know, those were always the hardest. Those are the songs with the most drafts. And the double vision of not only getting to make a movie of In the Heights, but filming it in the neighborhood it's about. You know, again, like, I remember John called me one day, we were in pre-production, and John called me and said, we're rehearsing when you're home. I'll text you the address of where we're rehearsing it. And it was in J. Hood Wright Park, which I walked through with my son every day to take him to pre-K. It was also where my wife lived in her first apartment when we were dating. And again, like, my first date with my wife, she grew up in Washington Heights too, was us taking each other to our favorite places in the neighborhood. That is the basis of the song When You're Home. I was writing that song while we were falling in love in real time. And so I called Vanessa and said, I know you're working, but you really have to get the fuck over here to watch these. They're filming it in J. Hood Wright Park. Yeah. And she comes to the set and she just looks up and she goes, that's my grandmother's building. And her grandmother's building is just north of the park. I go, yeah. And she goes, my grandmother's building is going to be in this movie.
Oh my
God. And my wife cried. Now listen, my wife didn't cry at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. That movie ended. Yeah. She said, that was good. It was sad.
Like, that's fine. Whatever.
Wow. So again, like there's so, like I can point at every scene in this movie and point out not only where I was when I was writing the song, but where in that neighborhood that represents for me. Mm-hmm. My, towards the end of my abuela's life, she was in a nursing home on 190th and Wadsworth. I had to pass through that mile long 190th Street one train tunnel every day to go see her. I'd buy her $5 lottery tickets and a cup of coffee from the bodega next to the nursing home. And the fact that Abuela Claudia sings her song in that tunnel is insane to me. There's so many layers to the shit. Like, I'll be unpacking it for the rest of my life.
You definitely feel it though. And like we me and Amanda can't stop talking about how we connected with this. Even though neither of us are, you know, Latino. It's like we're just, I was crying throughout the whole
Yeah, I was gonna say, like when you mentioned Nina, we just had Anthony on the podcast and we were just talking about how much I related to Nina's story. This is something that like I've been through. Like I get what the father-daughter dynamic. It all like made so much sense. And I really love that the universal quality of this movie. Like you don't need to be somebody from the Latino community to get it. It was something that like I said, I was so easily connected to. Let me ask you. So the obviously there were updates to this version versus your original the theater version that you had written. How did you and John and Kiera sort of collaborate to figure out which of the original like elements you wanted to include in the film and which things that you wanted to update for this version?
I think one of the big advantages we had, I think it begins with Kiera, because you have to remember that Kiera came on board to start working with me when I already had these characters and I had some of the songs. And so, and she'll be the first to admit to say, like, I was playing catch up. You already had a shorthand with Tommy Kail. And like, I was trying to figure out my role in this. And we really kind of started from scratch again with Kiera. You know, Abuela Claudia, I had written a song for her, but I didn't know how she integrated into the larger story yet. The salon ladies sort of really find form. The community really finds form when Kiara's on board. But with the screenplay, Kiera said to me, let me get a head start. Like, let me actually write the screenplay ahead of it. I think I'll be braver in my choices if we're not both staring at this thing we co-parented. And so that was fantastic. And so she took the first stab at the screenplay. And then what she and John really settled on, because John's whole thesis was, this is gonna be as grounded in the real world on location as possible. And the more grounded we are, the bigger we can go when we go to their dreams. Like that's like the more rooted we are, the higher we can kind of take the musical sequences and go full Hollywood and go full fantasy sequence. And his option, he always opted for the most cinematic version of telling the story. Like 96,000, why don't we do that in the pool of 175th with 500 fucking dancers.
That was
do that
one of Rogers. My favorite scenes. Yeah,
yeah. It's like the whole movie. Every company routine is just like, why didn't I get invited to perform? Like you want to be involved. It's because I missed the party. Like.
I think When the Sun Goes Down is a stroke of genius to have him throw his hair up the side of the building with Nina. You can't do that on stage. Yeah. So again, it's like he's always choosing the option that you can't do on stage and pushing us to go bigger and the fantasies go bigger. And then the stuff in the real world is so rooted. You will not hear a more complicated reaction than watching Mark Anthony's appearance in this movie in Puerto Rico, where I saw it. where we're used to seeing him in a shiny suit at the Coliseum, and there he is, and because people forget what an incredible actor he is, like just playing that part and that uncle or that, you know, Theo that we all have, and it's so real. Real from the like the what's on the TV to the box fan in the apartment to the bottles around the apartment. I mean, it's so fucking real. So like it, like the realer you get in those moments, like the bigger you can go in the fantastic moments.
I've never really noticed that. Wow, we learn something new every day.
And I mean, I love how big this movie was in scope. It was so bright, colorful. It was so exciting. Dino and I talked about it and we were like, this kind of feels like we're getting a Black Panther Crazy Rich Asian moment again for the Latino community. I feel like when we talk about representation a lot, especially in this business, we don't really talk about the Latino community. It's usually like Black, you know, maybe Black, white, maybe Asian, maybe LGBTQ. But we don't talk about the Latino community and the representation that we have on screen. And this movie obviously comes at a much needed time. What do you hope take away from this? And what do you hope this movie can do for the Latino representation when it comes to like film and television?
Honestly, like my big dream is that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're saying, what was the big deal about In the Heights? We get a Latino movie every month now.
Yeah. Right?
Anthony's in every third movie now.
He is a leading man.
He's fighting Transformers as we speak, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But again, like, and I saw how brilliantly John threaded this needle with Crazy Rich Asians. You know, so often we're given the lie. And it happened on the first go round of this was like, well, there are no Latino international movie stars, so we can't greenlight your movie. And this gives the lie to that because Leslie Grace is a movie star and Melissa Barrera is a movie star and Corey Hawkins is a movie star. So the fact that, you know, and again, like it's, so that's the hope. And again, and that's the other thing, the tricky thing about Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians is they are much needed and they are barrier breakers. And I remember going and supporting Black Panther, going to the theater to support Crazy Rich Asians. And at the same time, no movie can represent us all. It's
right.
Just not possible.
Right.
And so there will be discourse around that as well. And there will be Latinos who see this movie and say, I don't see my story up there. And the importance is going to be the shift from representation to power so that those stories get their platform and those stories can be told as well. And to just sort of create a lane for that. Because I started writing In the Heights because I knew I'd never get cast as Bernardo. And I really wanted a life in musicals. Yeah. And that was all we had. And it was 50 years old by the time I started writing this thing. And so if In the Heights is begat out of West Side Story, out of necessity, what will In the Heights beget? And I cannot tell you, you know, I remember DMing with Dominique Fishback and her saying, In the Heights was my first Broadway show. And for that to be normal, for a stage full of Latinos to be the entry point for her and that inspiring her to write theater, like means the world to me.
Yeah.
That's the part that chokes me up is the like, I see that and that means I'm allowed to write my story.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's a correct answer. Thank you.
I didn't know there was a right or wrong answer, but I'm glad I hit the button.
We've been testing you this whole time.
Yeah. No, these kind of projects is what gets us excited. And it gets, I always think about what's going to come next after this, right? Like what's going to be the next thing, not necessarily the next Black Panther, because that's for
people
to live on its own, but the next thing, right? The next story that we haven't heard, these types of projects, like I get excited because I feel like hopefully they open doors, they open doors for more opportunities for people of color, for people that like were usually in the margins to tell their stories and to have different types of stories and all that. So we're very excited about this. everybody needs to see it when it comes
out. In the theater. I'm going to go see it in the theater.
Yeah, we didn't get to see, I'm definitely seeing it in the, it's a theatrical movie, you guys. It is something that
if you don't, we're going to track you down.
Oh my goodness.
We know you're super busy. You have Tick Tick Boom, you have the Little Mermaid movie. You're doing a whole bunch of stuff. But what's next? So this movie comes out June
11.
What's next after this is sort of like completed? What are you working on next?
So the pandemic scrambled my plans a lot and pushed everything to this year. So I have an animated movie I've been working on for 11 years. Mm. The past five of them with Kiara, called Vivo. Netflix, I think hopefully later this summer, which is, we went from like, when is it coming out to like, oh, it's coming out tomorrow. and I actually started writing that in 2009. Like it shares a lot of the musical DNA of In the Heights, because I was writing those around the same time. Okay. And then I have Tick Tick Boom, which my editor is downstairs right now under instructions not to hog the Wi-Fi so I can talk to you guys. And then I've been working on this animated score called Encanto, that's set in Colombia, and that has been a total joy. And I turned in the last song 2 weeks ago, which is, you know, just a little past my deadline since the movie came out in November and they have to animate it.
There's no, you know, deadline, pandemic deleted all deadlines.
and I think Rob has been working on Little Mermaid like in the UK, like this whole time, like this whole top of the year. So I'm really excited to sort of see all that. I'm excited to see Hallie.
And hopefully
the recording sessions in January of 2020. And then like the songs were done
I'm excited for that one.
Wait for that one. Yeah.
And a Sprite commercial, maybe. A Sprite commercial.
Listen, we need to bring back like hip hop artists writing original tunes.
for Sprite.
Okay, in terms of like commercial hip hop, there are two things I miss. I miss the Sprite commercials. Although, you know, we did get a late inning one with Drake when his like head popped open. That was cool. And then the other thing is I miss hip hop songs at the end of the movie that summarize the movie.
Oh, that's a good
one. That was
one.
Like a whole thing in the 80s and 90s where it was like, again, it's like, Will Smith with Men in Black, you know, the Addams Family, MC Hammer.
Oh, MC Hammer.
I would love, I mean, it's not quite right for Tick Tick Boom, but how great would it be if there was just a song that summarized the plot?
Yeah.
They are rebooting House Party. Which one?
The Ninja Turtle one.
The hash fell that the heroes for. In this day and age, who could ask for more?
that just popped into
Oh my God. Yeah, we do
Partners
need
in Crime. That was the name of the group that sang that song.
Yeah.
Partners in Crime, K-R-Y-M-E.
Oh my God. That's a good point. Like the rap summary of a movie.
There was a guy, Demi, on Twitter, who's a writer on The Good Place, did one for Get Out. He wrote a fake one for Get Out.
Really? Well, I need to look that one up.
Hilarious.
Okay.
And it's him as Will, like it's a Will Smith version of the closing credit rap for Get Out. Go watch that right now.
So Lynn, we like to end our conversations, you know, asking, you know, if there is an give a shout out to an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's a writer, creator, actor, producer, anyone who's not necessarily in the mainstream, that's up and coming, that you think people need to know about, that you just want to give shine to. I mean, people, you know, I think the industry is very insular, but there's like kind of someone who's not mainstream, that's they're doing something really dope. That you just want to say, hey, listen to this, watch them, watch this, anything. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Actually, you know what? I'm gonna actually go back into my little theater lane. One of the most exciting shows I saw before the world closed was a musical called A Strange Loop by a young writer named Michael R. Jackson. It is an incredible coming of age story, sort of growing up gay and Black in the Bible Belt in the South. Ooh. It is unbelievable score. And, you know, that was all set to run the table as sort of the next Broadway musical. I'm hoping there's still, I'm not involved in the show at all. I don't have a horse in the race.
Yeah.
You're
just a fan. You're just a fan.
Writing, and I can't wait for the world to discover it, because it's a really original voice in the world of musical theater. I can't wait to see it.
What, say the name again?
The name is Michael R. Jackson. The show is called A Strange Loop.
The Strange Loop.
Okay, look out for that. I'm trying to go to New York soon, so you know, hopefully,
and Broadway's opening back up. So hopefully, fingers crossed.
Hopefully, some stuff opened more. Yeah,
I hope it finds its way back, because it's so incredible.
Lynn, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for chatting with us. Me and Amanda are fans. I'm a diehard fan from when I won the lottery to see Hamilton in February of 2018.
And I finally got to see it when it came on Disney Plus, the lottery. I tried. So. I wasn't fortunate, but we did a whole family thing when it came on Disney Plus. We were all, it was amazing. Like it was my brother was singing on top of, my brother just loved the soundtrack, singing on top of his lungs. Like it was a good experience. Yeah.
And so, just thank you, Lynn, for all you do, you know, and just bringing your art to the masses. And changing lives.
Champion, you know, and representation and all that stuff. This is what we get, like I said, we get excited about, and we're appreciative about. So thank you for all that you do.
Yeah. And then call me if you want to do a Sprite commercial. So. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Great talk. Thank you.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit amfam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.